Well, good morning, Richard King.
Good morning.
Welcome to Free Metal Shipping News.
Thank you, Bruce.
Should I say welcome back to Free Metal Shipping News because you've been here before?
I have indeed.
You had
a chat with Michael.
You chatted with our editor, I think probably a bit over a year ago, about your first book, Here Be Monsters. And now, only, 12 months, 15 months later, here's another book, Brave New World.
Yes.
So can you tell us pretty much, or just outline what motivated you to write these two books and how they're connected?
Sure, thank you. Technology, I think, is the key issue, one of the key issues of our time. And I think new and emerging technologies are in many ways qualitatively different to the technologies that we've had in the past, in the sense that in the past we've used technology to bend capricious nature to our will or protect ourselves from nature's caprice. But what we're doing increasingly through bioscience and AI, of course, and nanotechnology is reconstituting the elements of nature itself. And I don't think we've quite caught up to this change. And there's, of course, a lot of chatter about technology, but it's the kind of discussion, it's the kind of chatter that you'd expect to find in a society set up along these lines. That's to say, it's about privacy, surveillance, very important questions. But I wanted to write about the ways in which these new technologies in particular are affecting us in our deepest being. And so I wanted to sort of blow the dust, if you like, off what I call the techno-critical tradition.
Yes.
Which is a tradition going back to Socrates and including such luminous names as, Marshall McLuhan, Neil Postman, Heidegger, lots of others. Interesting stuff. And what I did in Here Be Monsters, which is subtitled Is Technology Reducing Our Humanity, was to ask that question, and in order to test my hypothesis that it was reducing our humanity in some respects, and or going against the grain, if you like, of the human condition, I needed some minimal idea of what our humanity was. And so I divided the book into three sections, one of which dealt with our social being, one of which dealt with our physical being, and the last of which dealt with our creative being, especially as it's connected to questions of freedom and agency.
Now, did you have Brave New World in mind as you were writing Here Be Monsters, or did that sort of dawn on you towards the end?
Well, towards the end more, I think. Probably as I was finishing up, I knew that that was one direction in which my thoughts as set out in Here Be Monsters might lead me in. Because what I've done in this new book is really to put that minimal idea, if you like, of human nature or the human condition next to these technologies that are now being talked about with regard to the environmental crisis. As you can tell, the title of the book is an allusion to Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, and what Huxley does in that book is to imagine a society that's deep in the future and perfect, or logical anyway, rational, organized, integrated, productive. The only problem with it is that human beings, in their natural condition at least, don't do terribly well. So rather than change the society such that it engenders happier human beings, the controllers, as they're called, of the world state, as it's called, decide to change the human beings such that they can fit into the society. And that seems to me to be what we're proposing to do with regard to non-human nature increasingly as we get into what I call the era of the techno-fix. But there is that link between Here Be Monsters and Brave New Wild, in the sense that in Here Be Monsters I'm really saying, look, these technologies might be in the process of making us uncanny to ourselves and to one another. And what I'm doing in Brave New World is talking about the way in which we're looking to reconstitute nature in a way that, again, may be very bad for us in the long term.
And you refer to, I mean, there's a lot of kind of jargon in Brave New World, from what I remember. Mm. I mean, Huxley invents his own language to some extent.
Yeah.
And you use terms, and I'm not sure whether they're always original terms, but I think they need some teasing out. Mm. Eco-modernism, for example. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, not entirely original, but not very well known either. Mm. And eco-modernism, in my analysis at least, and I think this certainly overlaps with the way that word has been used in the past, describes the tendency to look at the environmental crisis, at climate change and its attendant calamities, as a technical problem first and foremost, demanding technological, technocratic responses, as opposed to some deeper interrogation about how we got here and how we might change society, politics and so on, in order to cope with this radically, dramatically changing world. So I think there are, it's probably useful just to distinguish between sort of different kinds of eco-modernists. So you've got your kind of hardcore eco-modernists, that is to say the people who would identify themselves as such, people like Stuart Brand and the Breakthrough Institute and things like that. And they're an interesting crowd. But I think more interesting and more important is this sort of large periphery of engineers, scientists, politicians, philanthropists, NGOs, commentators, journalists, authors, who now default to thinking of climate change as a technical problem needing a technical answer. And part of the reason for that, of course, I mean, I think it's overdetermined in the sense that there are many reasons, but part of the reason is that the risk of doing too little too late is a tipping point that's already been passed. And so the risk calculus is changing now very quickly and very dramatically, such that I think people are now beginning to cast around for a sort of quick fix technological solution to some of these problems.
Many people have put all their eggs in the basket of techno-fix, haven't they? I mean, Stuart Brand is one example, and I think you have a lovely quote that you use in the book from him, where he says that we are as gods and have to get good at it. Okay, so why do you think that thinking is misguided at best and dangerous at worst?
Yeah, well, Brand's an interesting cat. So he's an old countercultural type. He was the guy who originated the Whole Earth catalogue that many old hippies around Fremantle will remember. And it's interesting, on the front cover of that first issue, and indeed of all subsequent issues, you had a picture of the planet taken.
Whole Earth catalogue, I remember it vaguely. So we're talking 1970s, aren't
we? Yeah, yeah. Well, very late 1960s. Continued through the 1970s. Mm. And you had on the front cover a picture of Earth taken from space. And as I say, he was kind of countercultural type back in the day and very kind of libertarian. And the point of the Whole Earth catalogue was to sort of connect people, you know, to get tools to people so that they could, literally tools, technologies, so that they could sort of take control of their own lives. But over the years, he's sort of gone from this sort of techno-libertarian to this sort of, managerial kind of eco-pragmatist, if you like, eco-modernist indeed. He's the avatar of the eco-modernist, really. And part of my argument is that these pictures from space, which are often credited, Earthrise, you know, the blue marble, that sort of thing, Earth rising on the moon's horizon. Beautiful images, awesome images. Part of my argument is that these images that and this moment that many people credit with having sort of kick-started the modern environmentalist movement, that within that is a kind of techno exuberance, if you like, because it is so bound up with the space race. And what happens is that in looking at the world in this way, again, very awesome images, but sort of marbled into the response is this idea that the Earth is a single system that can be sort of, you know, that can be managed as such. And this is where a lot of those guys have ended up, you know, in thinking that you somehow need to take control of the world's, you know, of nature's systems in order to save nature itself. So this is the sort of eco-modernist ethos distilled, if you like.
What do you think lies behind that? That need to control, that need to have some sort of definite thing rather than to remain really curious about the interaction, the interconnectivity of more than just a single unit?
Well, that's where the quote comes in, isn't it, Bruce? Mm. You know, we are as good. I think Brand said originally in that first issue of the Whole Earth Catalogue, we are as gods and might as well get used to it. That's now changed in his subsequent writings to we are as gods and have to get used to it. But yes, I think it's, you know, it's a Promethean moment. It's good old-fashioned hubris, you know. And I think there is that need, and I think it, you know, it's buried deep in our culture. It goes back to the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution. You know, you could really begin this story from any of those points.
Yeah.
So the problem with it, of course, is that it vastly overstates. Or it vastly understates, let's say, how contingent our existence is here and how vulnerable we are to the vicissitudes of nature. So it's a fantasy of control.
Yeah, a fantasy. And then you go on and talk about the god of small things, nanotechnology.
Oh, yeah.
Which...
the big to the small.
I think most listeners may have a vague idea, but can you sort of enlarge on what's really meant by nanotechnology? And also, there's a wonderful quote, I think, that you use, a line from David Brewer, where he says that new technology is guilty until proven innocent. So can you kind of summarise the potential benefits and all the and also the dangers of...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, nanotech is the one that kind of gets forgotten a bit because it didn't seem to have taken off in quite the way that people were expecting. But that's because it's more of a platform than a single technology, and many things are being done on the basis of it. But essentially what's going on here is that engineers are and technicians are now making things at the nano scale. So the key measure of the nanoscale is the nanometer, which is 1/1,000,000th of a meter, which for your listeners, if it helps at all, is the distance your fingernail grows in a single second. So take a particle of pollen or something like that, that might be 500 to 5,000 nanometers across. So you're talking about stuff at the atomic and subatomic level. And what happens when you manufacture nanoparticles, which is defined as any particle with one dimension from 1 to 100 nanometers, is that you find we get this from quantum physics, you find that the reactions between materials become very, very different. And it's kind of technical, but that's because those reactions happen at the surface. And what you have in a nanoparticle is an object where the surface area is huge relative to its overall size. So this is why nanotech products, such as graphene, for example, which is a single layer of carbon atoms, have these remarkable properties and very many different properties. So graphene, for example, will certainly be used, if they're not being used already, in the next generation of, you know, microtransmitters. The dangers are of two kinds, and this is something that kind of runs throughout the book, trying to distinguish these two these two sets of dangers, which are, of course, closely related. But there are the material dangers. So there's the danger of nanopollution, for example. Some people, some papers would suggest that nanotechnology can be, you know, some nanotechnologies can be as dangerous as asbestos. There's also the picturesquely named grey goo scenario, where you might be using, say, a self-replicating nanomachine to clear up some oil spill or something like that, and then it just continues to replicate itself and then end up consuming the world. Nanotechnologists are quite sort of dismissive of that scenario now, but I have to admit, I'm not quite sure why, because it seems to me to be fairly feasible. At least the potentiality, but then of course there are other dangers to do with treating nature as something that is endlessly malleable. Objects are, if you like, twice manufactured. They are made from made materials, and of course the temptation, this is why it links so directly to eco-modernism, the temptation is to now think of nature as something that can be endlessly remade in the service of our own system, such as it is.
So basically we hand over a lot of power to people to basically roll out these technologies without 99% of the population, probably 99.9% of the population, having a clue exactly what underpins.
If that, absolutely. And you know, and the world itself becomes a black box, designed for automatic operation.
And you go on and talk, I'll jump from nanotechnology now to the actual data storage. I think the chapter after is headed The World as Data or something along those lines. And can you talk about the storage of data and the implications that exist?
Yeah, well, again, there are different kinds of implications. So I think we're getting over this idea now that the internet and digital technology more generally is a clean technology. I think we've got that point, you know. One of the reasons all of the tech bros are now spruiking for nuclear is because they know that if they want the kind of AI that they're looking forward to in the future, and they want virtual reality and all the other goodies, all the other cool stuff that they're promising the world or threatening us with, they're going to have to pull much more power than they're pulling at the moment. And they're pulling a lot, and you need to dig up a lot of rare earths and minerals in order to give effect to these technologies as well. So that's one thing. The chapter "Our World as Data" is sort of a pun or a poke at Bill Gates's website, "Our World in Data," which is this sort of massive website populated almost entirely by these sort of charts and what you might call dashboards. So it gives you all of the latest stats on, pollution or climate change or, other things that don't pertain directly to the environment, like, poverty, that sort of stuff. The problem with that, and of course AI is looking for a good news story because it is, it's really lost that sort of, the sort of cachet that it had, say, in the 2000s and even in the 2010s. Because of the way it's behaved, because of the
you
way
mean
in
people,
which
people are basically starting to raise eyebrows rather
people
than...
are annoyed with them. Mm. People are furious with them. In fact,
Some people.
Yeah. I hope I can say this on the shipping news, but I'm just reviewing a book. I've just finished reading it this morning called In Shitification by Cory Doctorow. And, it's about all the ways in which, these digital platforms just like got to make our lives an absolute misery now. But, But there was looking for a good news story. And what it often says, the AI industry, when it's challenged on the amount of power that it's using and the amount of damage that it's doing to the world in terms of the raw materials it needs in order to exist, is, well, these AIs, these dashboards, they're going to be used in the environmentalism of the future in order to map and to eventually intervene in, you know, the world systems, the nature systems, its processes, its ecologies, you know, because what we need to do is to get as many data points as we can. And then, you know, as with the nanotechnology, then everything becomes sort of malleable, everything becomes subject to our to our will. They don't put it in quite those terms, but but you see where they're going with it. And this is true to some extent. These models now have great resolution, as they call it. You know, when chances are, when Hurricane Melissa smashes into Jamaica and Cuba and Haiti, what you're looking at oftentimes on the TV when that news story comes on, it's not the hurricane itself, but a digital, you know, imagining, if you like, or a digital rendition, an abstraction of that particular hurricane. Now, the problem with this is that nature isn't digital. Nature is analog. And again, it feeds this fantasy that somehow nature can be, so to speak, recoded.
You know, you talk about the swerve towards abstraction rather than the reality that what we call nature is.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are abstractions all over the place in this book, and that's quite right. You know, that's kind of what I'm talking about. You know, we live our lives at the human level, and yet we're beginning to think of this problem of climate change and the eco crisis more broadly in sort of either very, very big terms or very, very small terms. And, you know, it's about how we live. It has to be about how we live. We can't just keep, you know, kind of abstracting up or abstracting out from where we are and expect someone to come in and re-engineer nature such that we can survive within what's left of it once we've had our way.
Yeah. Yes, I've just read a book called Arborescence by Rhett Davis. I think he's a Indigenous Victorian writer, and he's talking about it's almost there's an element of what we used to call science fiction brought into the play, where in this book people who are so disillusioned with what's happening on a human level decide to convert themselves into trees to replace the forests, and so they plant themselves, and for a start they're regarded as completely bizarre and idiots, and then somebody's doing some research on it, and so it's actually happening. Yeah. So it's interesting to see, and that's, in a sense, it's a way of reclaiming through the human form nature. Novelists are thinking about these questions.
Oh, yeah.
Poets are thinking about these questions. It's the creative input imaginative input that's actually quite...
Well, in Kim Stanley Robinson's book, Ministry for the Future, actually begins with... it's a lethal heat wave in India, beautifully described, terrifyingly described in the book, and people trying to get cool by sitting in, you know, sort of muddy water that's probably going to, you know, increase their temperature rather than decrease it. But and, you know, India sort of fire, you know, unilaterally declaring for geoengineering, you know, fire, you know, what do they call it, stratospheric aerosol injection, where you fire sulfates. I mean, there are a lot of people now in favor of this, including the late Paul Crutzen, who gave us the Anthropocene label, including
the term Anthropocene.
And including James Hansen, who, you know, the father of climate change, his research. You know, a lot of people in favour of this now, sensible people. I don't think it's a sensible solution, but these are sensible people. Mm-hmm. But you would fire sulfates into the Earth's upper atmosphere in order to, you know, block out radiation from the sun. mimicking the cooling effect of large-scale volcanic eruptions. And this happens within Kim Stanley Robinson's book, and it could happen here. I find it easy to imagine Trump, who came to power, of course, on a promise to drill, baby, drill. You know, looking down the same camera with the same stupid look on that stupid apricot face, saying, you know, we're going to spray, baby, spray, because it's just an easy solution, and you know it works because it works when there's a massive volcanic eruption, and when your proof of concept is Krakatoa, you know the situation is pretty dire.
It's as if people. It's almost like there's a giant cost-benefit analysis around everything, and then there's a camp that are predisposed to go that route, that technological route, and then there are those, and possibly a much smaller camp, who are really well and truly aware of the inherent dangers.
Yeah.
And probably there's a lot of people in the middle that don't have an opinion, the usual.
Yeah, and I think that my sense is that the people who are exuberant about the technology, who are excited by the idea of these kind of interventions, if you like, the hardcore eco-modernists are now coming, you know, that ethos of excitement and exuberance is now joining with a more general sort of sense of kind of pragmatic despair, really. Like we don't want to do this, but we're going to have to do it, because the risk of not doing it is so much greater. I don't think it is so much greater, but that would be the calculus.
Yeah. Well, and what interests me too, in your book, is, you know, you describe a lot of quite technical stuff, and you basically explain it in ways that are very coherent and clear, I found.
Thank you.
But it also, what really touched me in the book is when you describe your own experience. It's almost like a sort of a mini epiphany. I think you can tell listeners about it when you were with a group on Sullivan Rock in the Darwin Range.
Yeah,
can you describe that experience?
That was a very interesting night. That was around my 54th birthday, and my family had given me a present of a sort of organized tour of a small group up to the top of, I think it's Mount Vincent, isn't it? That sits above.
Not sure.
Yeah, Mount Vincent. So we had a sort of light supper up there, watched the sun go down over the ocean, and then a sort of night walk back through the Jarrah bush down to the top of Sullivan Rock, where an astronomer was waiting in the dark with his telescopes about the size of it wasn't huge, but it was a bit bigger than the kind of telescope that you'd be used to seeing in somebody's house, and he was controlling it with a sort of smartphone app, and took us on a tour of the heavens, and he took us first to the nearest planets, and then to the nearest stars, and then to distant solar systems and this sort of thing. Very lovely evening, but then it was winding down, and we turned our headlight lamps on and the sort of off, but actually back on. But just as we did that, I saw this it was perfectly straight ellipsis of sort of maybe 10 to 15 lights just coming over the horizon. And I said, I said to the guy, what the hell is that? And he said, oh, that's, he sounded pretty grumpy about it, I have to say. He said, oh, that's Elon Musk's Starlink, you know, that's the next batch.
Starlink.
Yeah. Mm. And of course, I realized then that they'd been coming over all night. I'd been very reluctant when I first pitched this book to my publisher to include a chapter on space and space mining and space travel and asteroid mining and all this sort of stuff, because I thought some of the technologies in this book are going to sound so strange to people. They're going to sound less strange, I think, pretty soon. But anyway, they will sound so strange to people that really to get all sort of extraterrestrial about it might be a bit of a mistake. You know, it might sound a bit wacky, but it came apparent to me on that night, and indeed as the Google alerts came in over the course of the year that I was writing the book, that I was going to have to include it, because they are going to do it. They are going to go to the moon, and they're going, well, you know, they'll mine it for resources if they possibly can. They'll need to work out a way to get them back. Mm. And they'll, you know, they I don't, we're not looking at direct democracy on Mars anytime soon, to the extent that that's still in people's head, it is a very big case of moral hazard.
As you're talking, I'm thinking your experience looking at that line of, what were they, satellites?
Satellites.
Straight line, and there's the cosmos, and there's this straight line of satellites, which suddenly looks kind of like out of whack with everything else, and so it attracts your attention.
Yeah.
Your response to that is a very different emotional response to a lot of people who would look and think, that's fantastic, look at all those wonderful satellites circling the Earth. So it's really down to what we value in the natural state, what we call or have called the natural state, and how much can we interfere with that without compromising.
Absolutely.
And so this question of values is really interesting for me, because I see that if people have that kind of epiphany and say, well, shit, what's going on?
Yeah.
What's going on with that? You know, how much do we, can we, should we interfere?
Yeah.
And they'll come down in one way or come down in another.
Yeah.
And it's...
It's true. Yeah.
It's very interesting, because if you're in a... And you're growing up in a block of flats in a city of 10 million people, and you don't see much of what we call nature, then your enculturation is going to be totally different to somebody who is tramped in the mush, for example. So,
absolutely.
Any thoughts around that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, lots of thoughts, but maybe the beginning of wisdom is just to recognize that we are technological creatures. You know, this book, Here Be Monsters, they're not anti-technology books. That would be an absurd thing to write. The use of stone tools predates the emergence of Homo sapiens by some 3 million years. So we woke up in technology. There is no us without technology. So this is our point of entry into nature. It is in our nature to have a culture. It is in our nature to have technology. So there's no sense in which this is kind of against nature in that way that sometimes, you know, sort of you more sort of transcendental romantics can indulge in. And there's none of that. But it's this idea that we can manipulate it endlessly, and that there are no consequences for us if we take it upon ourselves so to do, that I think is dangerous. And, you know, the fact is that night sky, I get that people look up and they think, wow, that's amazing. But that, you know, that apart from anything, I mean, one of the things the astronomer was grumpy about was the fact that the light from the reflector shields that Starlink has is making mapping the heavens, you know, more and more difficult. So we're going to know, you know, potentially we'll know less about the night sky than we would do otherwise. And we'll know more about Elon Musk. And I don't know, I'm maybe loading the dice there. But I think we need to, there's a part of me that looks up at the satellites and I sort of think, it's kind of cool. But these ones go very, very fast, and they're constant. It's like, you know, it quickly becomes quite boring and sort of infuriating, because they're only orbiting, I think, at the distance of about 500 miles or something like that, which is not far at all. Mm. It's as satellites go.
That's a
slightly clumsy answer to your very good question, Val.
Yes,
but part of the solution to this to the eco crisis has to be technological. I've got no doubt about that. But what's gone missing is the kind of debate that, you know, we would have, or that was had, you know, back in the 60s, maybe the late 60s, 1970s, when the New Left was in its pomp, when the ecological movement was in a sort of different space, about political and social innovation. Of course, in the absence of that debate, technological innovation is going to come to the fore, and that's all we're sort of left with. As I said, and, you know, and as the risk calculus changes, that looms ever more as this sort of temptation just to go in there, mine the moon, You know, find a nearby asteroid. You know, I mean, that's nothing wrong with going and finding an asteroid and mining it for resources. But again, it's just more moral hazard, isn't it?
Not doing
the things that we know we should be doing.
Yeah.
Or I think that we should know that we should be doing. Yeah. And
because I suspect that the ethical aspect, as it does with many, many things, is ignored until it's just buried underneath. And yet you go on in one of your later chapters, you actually, I don't know whether it's deliberately provocative or not, but you talk about the good life. And you begin that chapter by talking about widespread feelings of hopelessness amongst scientists, and you contrast that with the more optimistic commentators, and then you go on to point out that the environmental crisis is also an identity crisis, inseparable from, and I'm quoting from you here, an incomplete view of what a human life should be. What do you actually mean?
Yeah, well, so this is in the final third of the book, so I've got a sort of orienting section where I think I've called it You Are Here or something like that. And then I've got sort of a big middle section where I talk chapter by chapter about these different technologies. And then in this final bit of the book, I sort of turn to these ideas of nature and try to give some different sense of how we might think about this problem. So what I wanted to say there was that this eco-crisis is not some sort of unfortunate externality of progress or overpopulation or anything like that, but it goes all the way down. It goes all the way down to the way in which we think about ourselves and about our own relationship to the natural world. You know, up until yesterday, to use Jared Diamond's, the anthropologist Jared Diamond's, you know, the world until yesterday. Up until yesterday, you know, we lived in a completely different relationship to nature. For the last 250 years or so, of course, extraction, expansion, growth has been the order of the day, and we're very habituated to that, of course, because we've never known anything different. And it's very difficult to sort of think our way around that, to some, you know, to imagine some sort of different dispensation. But I think if we're going to get through this in good shape, that's what we need to do. So I wanted to say that this was a crisis that went all the way down to how we think of ourselves and how we think of our relationship to non-human nature. You know, there's a tendency now amongst the eco-modernists and its periphery to sort of dismiss the notion of nature entirely and sort of say, well, human beings are naturally evolved animals, therefore anything they do is natural. And that's true in a sense, but we're also capable of the abstraction that you were talking about earlier. And we can hold this thing called, we can conceive of something called nature, which we hold in our heads. And this sort of double aspect of our being is very, very important to understand, I think, going forward. Not to sort of privilege one or the other, but to see that we are both a part of nature, but that we are in key ways apart from it as well. And that's, of course, a very philosophical way of thinking about it, and people may object that, you know, we haven't got the luxury of that at the moment. You know, we need to be pragmatic, and that's true. Where we are in 10 minutes' time depends largely on where we are now, but where we are in 10 minutes' time also depends on what we're facing. So we need to have these, I think, you know, to the extent that we can, in this fraught public sphere, and fraught and diminished public sphere, to the extent that we can, we need to have these conversations about direction.
It reminds me of, I can't remember the exact quote, but I think in your previous book, in Here Be Monsters, you took a quote from James Baldwin about unless we're facing it. Can you remember that quote? I can't remember it off the
top. Not everything that can be faced
Can be changed.
Can be changed, but nothing can be changed if it's not faced.
If it's not faced, yes. I thought it was a lovely quote, and it made me think of it then.
Yeah.
Flowing on from what you've just been talking about, you touch upon governance when you talk about individual states that need, and I'm quoting from you here, need to substantially devolve decision-making powers to local councils, cooperatives and so on, in a way that allows individual communities to take responsibility for themselves and their local environments. And then you go on to talk about a further devolution that's aimed at a thoroughgoing transformation of individual and community life. Now, this is not under the rubric of degrowth, but in line with the values of sociology, embodied pleasure and creativity that mark the human species out as a unique member of the animal kingdom. That's what you're saying there. And then you mention the Eco Village movement, which, as you know, I'm allegedly writing a book about intentional communities and how they handle conflict and so on and so forth. But what role, if any, do you see these kinds of intentional communities playing in the transformation you envisage?
Well, probably not much, in the sense that, you know, and I don't mean to be sort of dismissive of that movement, because it doesn't deserve to be dismissed, but I don't think we're going to be, you know, sitting around in intentional communities anytime soon, you know, sort of, you know, in smocks, you know, knitting our own houses, whatever. Weaving our own houses. So that's not going to happen. But our communities could do with
careful, Richard. Careful. I've got a lot of friends in intentional communities.
But our communities could do with a bit more intentionality, couldn't they? I mean, I do get the sense that people are up for a bit more intentionality, that, you know, tool libraries, repair cafes, that kind of stuff. The ethos of that moment, of that movement, I think, is very important going forward. Mm-hmm. It seems to me to be crazy that on a street like this, we're sitting in your beautiful house on in the middle of Fremantle. You know, there aren't many lawns here, but, you know, on my road, for example, you might have, I don't know, maybe 100 lawnmowers. Mm. You don't need 100 lawnmowers, you know. And, you know, we subscribe to these groups now, you know, Buy Nothing, and we do the op shopping and all this sort of stuff. And I think people are, you know, sometimes through simple necessity, just you know, a lot more open to those kinds of things, because they realise that, you know, always think this consumerism, greed sort of thing was always kind of, I consider myself a socialist, but I think it was always kind of overstated on the left, you know. I probably own 15 kettles in my life. It's not because I like going out and buying kettles. It's because the kettles I buy are rubbish, you know, whereas the kettle my grandmother had was fantastic.
Yes, well, that's, I mean, you know, yeah, exactly. You touch upon the consumerism idea, and a lot of people will have some fairly strong awareness of what's going on, and at the same time they'll feel quite helpless in making choices. So
would you
subscribe to the idea that we make our choices and be as aware as we can, and we make small choices, and that can be in a community that's not so-called an intentional community, but how we deal with our neighbours and how we help out, and we do share a lawnmower, for example, if you like. This can be replicated, and that creates perhaps over time a cultural shift rather than anything being imposed from above.
That's right, and I think it needs to be a nested response. So I do talk about this idea of devolution, not an original idea at all. Mm. Many degrowthers would agree with this. I have my problems with degrowth, but probably that's getting a bit deep into the weeds. I think in many ways we're going to need a more activist state. You know, there are certain things that the state needs to do in a complex society such as this one. Of course, there are things that the state needs to do. It needs to take control of energy for a start. Mm. You know, and get serious about the transition. That's the first thing it should be doing. But yes, to the extent, you know, so by all means, you know, act politically and think globally, as they used to say, and you know, vote for the right party. Become a member of the party. Get in the ear of your local representatives. You know, share your ideas, push the message that what's needed is a change, what's needed is a change in how we do things. You know, we need some new kind of dispensation. We need to change direction. It's going to be a long, long journey, but you need to start, you know, you need to start thinking about what the rate of travel and what the direction we're going in actually is. Mm-hmm. And part of that, of course, is realizing how we got here and how we think about things and how we might think in alternative ways about our lives and about, you know, what we need, what our real needs as human beings are. So yes, I think it is about that sort of, you know, it is so easy to, and very understandable to sort of despair. I mean, your lovely partner was saying earlier that she's been feeling, you know, sort of rather wretched because of what's going on in the world at the moment. And I think a lot of us feel like that. But at the, you know, but at the end of the day, hope, if it's to be meaningful, has to be embodied. It can't be just something that you carry around in your head. You know, it's a virtue. It's to do with your conduct. You know, pessimism of the intellect, as Gramsci says, but optimism of the will. That's what we've got to strive for, I think.
Well, yes, if I've understood you correctly, you know, when you talk about hope, you don't talk about it as another form of positive thinking, no, or simply sitting on one's hands and hoping for the best. You mean being engaged in some way, large or small, and not avoiding or denying the messy reality of,
that's right,
of the world around you.
That's right, a virtue. And there's no reason either to go into that in a sort of with a sort of puritanical mindset. I mean, I've got this idea, which I think it probably is fairly original, more original than eco-modernism anyway, my sort of alternative framework, if you like, for thinking about this problem of the eco-crisis is eco-humanism. And what I've tried to do there is to say that the way in which we approach the eco-crisis has to be combined with a more thoroughgoing interrogation of what it is that we feel we need, what our deep needs are, as opposed to, say, the thin satisfactions of those 15 kettles that I, you know, that frankly proved incredibly unsatisfactory. So, you know, what I want to do, I mean, hopefully over time this would resolve into some kind of political program that made people an offer out of which, you know, a meaningful offer and an attractive offer. You know, you get, yes, you know, we're going to have to make do with less. I think most of us would be fine with that. But you'll get, you know, you may have to work less. You may get more time to work on your house. You might get, you know, more say over what your local school does. You know, you may, you know, get out into the community a bit more. There may be more, you know, to use a word that was, you know, very current back when Ivan Illich was doing his thinking, you know, there may be more conviviality.
Conviviality.
Yeah. Well, beautiful word.
Another word that struck me, another concept and another area of creativity that you talk about is poetry. And you touch upon your love of poetry. And I think at one point you were walking under a bridge. I think it might have been in London and you catch a glimpse of an iridescent kingfisher. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure.
So aspect of your life?
Yeah, I was living in Jericho in central Oxford, actually. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place to live because you walk five minutes one way and, of course, you're surrounded by these incredible sandstone colleges, some of which were established, you know, 13th, 14th century. You walk 5 minutes the other way and you're out on the Thames path, you know, kind of heading for a pub and a pint of real ale. So pretty good place to squat for a while. And I was walking along the canal which kind of runs parallel to the Thames. And I, you know, having said that it was a great place to hang out, I was coming out of a pretty long, pretty deep depression. This is something that, you know, runs in my family, unfortunately. I come from a long line of jailbirds and lunatics.
Badge of honour. Badge of honour.
So I was walking along and I saw this king, very rare to see a kingfisher. And there's a lot of folklore in England about it being good luck and everything. And it was very beautiful. I don't know if people probably would have seen these little, very little bird, electric blue, beautiful, and orange just darts out of the bank where it has its little nest, and then sort of disappears. And coming out of this depression as I was, you know, I felt the need for a poem kind of present itself, and in the next few hours I sort of gave it life, and I've reproduced it in the book. But what I wanted to do in that chapter was the final chapter of that, yeah, it's the final chapter of the book, and it's called The Existential Environmentalist, which is a really, sounds to me like a really good title of a really bad book. What I wanted to do was just talk a little bit about what it might mean at the sort of individual level to have a different relationship with nature. And I know that the psychiatrists, you know, kind of listening to this, they might think, not that I want to malign psychiatrists, but they might think, oh, well, maybe you're a little bit manic or something like that. And yes, I get that, you know, I get that it could have been a bit of a symptom of something happening in my brain. But my question is, why this symptom? Why is it always this symptom? Why is it when I'm out there watching those things that I get that symptom? There is a joy in nature that I wanted to convey through that story. And
I think you conveyed it absolutely brilliantly, because it's as if, for me, it comes across as a metaphor for life.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor for life with the awe and the majesty and the joy, as you say, that is triggered in that moment by that kingfisher.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
the brevity of it, that was very much what I wanted, you know. I mean, Saul Bellow once said, you know, this idea that yes, you know, yes, it's over very quickly. And I think I compare it to a monk jack sort of jumping across a clearing. There were a lot of those around at that time.
And connected with that, I think, is also that the ability to hold the pain of what's going on and at the same time take in the joy.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's how that moment. Yeah. I think
the pain is the dark backing a mirror needs if you're going.
But not
to
be denied or ignored.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
yeah, that's right.
Richard, we've probably exhausted our time limit here, and I'm wondering where might the book be obtained if listeners are interested in picking
in
up a copy?
In all fine bookstores, and some disreputable ones as well, I very much hope. But people can pick up a copy at a New Edition.
Fremantle people, anybody?
Yeah, absolutely, or you can get it direct from the publisher, which is Monash University Publishing. Okay. They'd want me to underline that twice and put it in bold and italics. Monash University Publishing, wonderful publisher. They've been great to me. But yeah, try and get it from New Edition. Support your local independent bookstore. So much more meaningful to have one of those than the rest of the.
Well, that's where I got my copy, and I'm
thank you so
very
much.
Grateful for a local independent bookstore, and also for you for sitting down today and talking.
I've enjoyed it
with Fremantle Shipping News. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce.
Until next time round.
Cheers. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.